KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
49 Seattle.
We've shown that the carbon tax has led in the first few years to a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, a reduction in fuel use, and yet the GDP of the province has continued to go up.
I fell into a realm of utter surprise in which everything we know about just about everything turns out to be wrong.
And once you get a company going and you start having to create things on a regular basis, then you really find out, okay, what's in here in terms of craft and what have I really learned about being able to make something out of nothing?
Choreographer Jason Olberg speaking about how he got into the arts. Howard Bloom speaking about the discoveries that inspired his book, The God Problem. And the Honorable Terry Lake talking about the carbon tax in British Columbia, which is where we start this hour. This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. This week, the Washington State Legislature passed an act that calls for the exploration of the best practices to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases to their 1990 level by 2020. A far cry from actionable action that the legislature might be taking, but it is a divided legislature. A report will be due by fall. The working group that's established must recommend a state program to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions that, if implemented, would achieve the state's emission limits. There was, as you can imagine, politics at play before the bill made it through the legislature. Senator Doug Erickson, a Republican, hosted a climate denier before the committee he chairs on Tuesday. The denier said the data from NASA, NOAA, and the National Science Foundation was suspect. Given the resistance among many Republicans to the scientific data on climate change, and that the Republicans in the Senate are framing the bill as a way to control spending on climate change efforts, I asked the bill's Senate sponsor, Democrat Kevin Ranker of the 40th Legislative District, whether they'll be able to reach a consensus in the final report.
What we saw with the original bill was that the chair of the committee, the Republican chair of the committee, brought forward a striker that basically removed the entire intent section. So the intent section in the governor's greenhouse gas emissions climate bill was the section that talked about why we have a problem and the fact that we do have a problem. So all of the language saying that we have a problem and what it's doing in Washington State, such as impacts to our snow cap, to forest health, to sea level rise, and so on, all of that was removed. What was left in the bill was the language saying what we're going to do about it.
So does taking out the intent change the way the consultant who's hired will approach their work or the nature of how binding the consultant's report might be?
No, it does not. What does impact that, however, was the fact that they made, they being the Republican majority, changed within the bill the executive work group that will be formed, where you will have two senators and two House members and the governor will be the executive body that will review the recommendations from the consultant and move forward. That body now has, in the governor as chair, a non-voting chair. So it will be a truly bipartisan process. So if the Republicans are willing to work with us to develop solutions to how we're going to address climate issues in Washington State, then we're still okay. If we're going to have several months of debate on whether or not there's a climate problem at all, then we're not okay.
Well, they also have in the bill that for a recommendation to be included in the final report, it must be supported by a majority of the work group's voting members. So you have, right now you have Republicans and Democrats, so you have to at least three of those groups have to agree that these recommendations are a good idea.
That's right. That's right. At least one Republican will have to agree that it's a good idea, and I hope we can get there. I have faith that we can, and I'm feeling optimistic, and hopefully we can get there.
The Republicans have also said what we have here is a good economic analysis in place, that environmental legislation will have to be put to the test of economic rigor. Is that a good thing?
Well, I think that can be a good thing. I think that part of what's happening right now is some framing of this legislation by the Republicans, because frankly, I think they thought, the Senate Republicans thought, that it was going to come back to the Senate and they were going to have a second whack at this. And when it did not, and we very quickly moved it out of the House and directly to the governor's desk, The Republicans now, and particularly the chair who made those comments yesterday, are needing to frame the agenda in a way that looks better for them.
So what do you have with this bill that's now before the governor at this point, and he plans to sign it?
What we have is legislation that will move us forward in Washington State with a very thoughtful discussion of not whether or not climate is real, but what we are going to do about it. What actions can we take as Washingtonians that will address the very serious environmental, economic, cultural, and community impacts associated with climate change in Washington State?
To do that, you're going to hire a consultant. That consultant's going to take a look at what California's done, what British Columbia has done, also what other jurisdictions has done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is sort of down the road we were on when we had the Western Climate Initiative. That foundered on the idea of cap and trade. Where do you think this consultant should be looking?
I think they need to look at the examples you just gave and much more broadly. We need to look worldwide at what are the best examples of how different communities and governments have addressed climate issues. And it may be a patchwork. We may bring some ideas from one area and some ideas from another. What we saw with the cap and trade push a few years ago was significant pushback, but also some really difficult questions there. So it may not be that cap and trade is the way to go, but we probably do need to look at some sort of carbon pricing. And if that's the case, there's a number of models out there. But having a thoughtful discussion about that with all of the information before us, I think, is what we're trying to do here.
Why do you think you'll get that with this consultant? Why do you think that this will be a consultant unfettered by political machinations?
Because today my glass is still half full. Ask me again in a week and that may change. But at this point, I'm still feeling optimistic. And part of that, frankly, is our governor. We have one of the more outspoken governors on climate and one of the better educated governors on climate issues in the nation here in Washington State. And so I see a governor who's really willing to lead this discussion and push that agenda in a way that I believe will get us there. So it's not the consultant, it's going to be that executive work group. And my hope is that the Republicans will come to the table and participate, and the facts will speak for themselves.
Let me ask you, Kevin Ranker, about one testimony that was in before the House, and this was where people were listing their concerns. And this was Todd Myers, who does environmental work for the conservative think tank, the Washington Policy Center. There are concerns about how much the state is spending to achieve the greenhouse gas reductions. Washington is currently spending $35 per ton of carbon reduced, while California spends $13 per ton of carbon reduced. Policymakers should be looking for policies which get the most bang from their buck. What, if you can tell me, what is he referring to there? But also, will economic necessities or at least beliefs hem in the effort to reduce greenhouse gas reductions in Washington?
So, 2 points. I'm not sure his numbers are accurate, but I don't have the data in front of me. So we'll go with that. On the second piece, what we have to realize is there are serious economic impacts currently because we're not doing enough to address climate change. Look at ocean acidification, for instance. We are already losing jobs in our very important shellfish industry here in Washington State because of ocean acidification, which is directly contributed to by carbon emissions. So we need to get in front of those issues and do something, actually come up with some actions that we can take. More specific to your question, however, the economics of these, of any decisions or recommendations that the executive work group comes up with will have to be taken into consideration and given very careful consideration, because this isn't just an environmental issue, this is an economic issue. And there are pros and cons, there are pluses and negatives on that. There are going to be impacts to businesses by taking action, but there are currently significant impacts by doing nothing, by taking no action. So all of those things have to be taken into consideration.
So you think you can use the economic argument to put forth environmental change?
We are using the economic argument to put forth environmental change. And, you know, both forest health and ocean acidification are two very clear examples of negative impacts to our local economies due to climate change.
That's Kevin Ranker. He's a Democrat, represents the 40th Legislative District in the State Senate, one of the sponsors of the climate change legislation that has made it through the legislature, one of the first bills to reach Governor Inslee's desk. He's expected to sign it. By May, they'll put in place that working group, a representative from each of the different branches of the legislature, so Democrat and Republican from the Senate and the House. And then they'll hire a consultant. They have to have a report out by the fall that the legislature will consider, vote on, and then apparently we'll see some movement towards efforts to reduce greenhouse gas reduction in Washington State through some of the recommendations they make. There are, of course, some West Coast entities that have already moved forward on dealing with climate change. Washington State has done it as well, but the legislature has been slow to put a lot of policies in place. Two governments on the West Coast have two different approaches to greenhouse gas reductions. British Columbia taxes carbon. California has put in that cap and trade system, and they're trying to make it work. But in British Columbia, the carbon tax has been around for a while. There's been a new report on that carbon tax that's also been saying it didn't work, and folks saying, oh, yes, it did. Terry Lake is the Minister of Environment in British Columbia. He joins us by phone. Terry Lake, thank you for taking the time.
You're very welcome, Steve. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. Tell me first a little history. Remind us, why did British Columbia go with a carbon tax?
Well, former Premier Gordon Campbell was very determined to take action on climate change, and we developed a climate action plan in 2007, and we wanted to have the most simple, broad-based approach to carbon pricing possible. And when you talk to economists, taxing carbon is the simplest way to do that and the most comprehensive way. It's essentially an economic and climate policy because we are taxing something we don't want, carbon pollution, and reducing taxes on things we do want, which are income and jobs. So our carbon tax is revenue neutral, meaning that for every dollar we raise in carbon taxes, other taxes, whether they be personal income taxes, small business tax, corporate taxes, are decreased an equal amount. That way we don't have a net increase in taxes, but we do have a price signal there that incents people to use less carbon.
How does the carbon tax lower your emission then?
Well, because you make choices. I, as a consumer, can choose to drive an electric car, which I do. I can choose to insulate my home, and we have incentive programs that have been available for people to do that. I can make choices about taking transit versus an automobile. So people make individual choices. Corporations, institutions make choices about the way they use carbon to reduce their carbon tax liability.
Don't you run into the problem, though, of as people reduce their carbon use, you don't get the revenue from the carbon tax?
Well, that's a very good question. And ideally, what would happen is the amount of reductions you would see would lead to an eventual decrease in the carbon revenues. We have been increasing our carbon price, starting out at $10 a ton and increasing to $30 a ton as of July of 2012. And that's where we have stayed and probably will stay for a while until we see other jurisdictions come along. But at the moment, we raise about $1.2 billion in carbon taxes. And, if we do see our carbon use go down, yes, we could anticipate a drop in those revenues, in which case, we'll have to look at the offsetting taxes on the other side of the equation.
Well, I know BC's population is growing too, but overall, have you seen your carbon use go down?
Well, our first progress report in 2011 was just looking at the very early years because the data always lags real time. But it did show that while our population grew and our economy grew, our greenhouse gases actually fell by 4.5%. And also, importantly, our fuel use compared to the rest of Canada also fell. If you look at you know, the 08 period, we had the recession, and so some of that reduction in greenhouse gases and fuel use could be related to the recession. We can see that. But after the recession was over, we saw the rest of Canada increase in terms of their fuel use. Here in British Columbia, it has continued to decrease, and early data from 2011 and 12 show that that's continuing to decrease as well.
You know, you have in California a different approach, the cap-and-trade approach, where they cap the emissions, they're going to ratchet it down, they'll trade the emissions on a market. Do you have to ratchet down at some point? Do you also have to just ratchet down the amount of greenhouse gas that you will emit in British Columbia?
Absolutely. We have targets of 33% reduction by 2020 and an 80% reduction by 2050. Those are legislated targets, so by law we have to meet those. We also have interim targets in 2012 of a 6% reduction, so we are approaching that. That data is coming in now, so we'll see if we're still on track. As I said, early days, we were meeting our targets, and we'll see what's coming at us in with the 2012 numbers. But, you know, our carbon tax captures about 70% of the carbon emissions, but there's still 30% of what we call process emissions that are not captured. Cap and trade is a system that would capture those, and we initially had planned on going into a cap and trade system with our Western Climate Initiative partners. But when that tended to, you know, the uncertainty was there as to who would be participating and how, we decided to back away from that because we didn't want to put an existing policy that's working very well at risk.
The Honorable Terry Lake is the Environment Minister in British Columbia. There was a report that came out just a couple days ago from the Auditor General, who was very critical of the carbon tax, and he said that the report was not meeting your objective of achieving a carbon-neutral public sector. I know you came out an hour after it was released and said that the report was wrong. We reject its conclusions. You said that an international group had measured your methods and found them more accurate. My question is, what's the politics going on here?
Well, there are actually two different issues. The Auditor General was looking at our carbon neutral government policy, which is quite apart from the carbon tax. We have committed to being carbon neutral by offsetting all the greenhouse gases that we emit as the public sector in British Columbia by buying offsets, which may be fuel switching, it may be growing more trees, silviculture, or it could be energy reductions in other areas. So the public sector pays into the Pacific Carbon Trust. The trust then buys these offsets, and the Auditor General looked at two particular offsets, and his conclusion were that they did not meet, you know, the standards of additionality. This has been a concern in carbon markets around the world. However, these offsets were verified by internationally recognized auditing firms that have expertise in that, and that's why we, you know, disagreed with the Auditor General's conclusions. But the Auditor General has not really passed any judgment on the carbon tax itself, only on the very small part of our policies, which is the carbon-neutral government policy.
But I guess that doesn't it point to the fact that even the carbon tax, which now everybody's looking at around the country, it's not the panacea that people hope in reducing greenhouse gas?
Well, I would say it's the most effective way to do that, but it's not without its detractors. About 64% of British Columbians in the latest poll support the carbon tax, but that leaves 36% that don't. And, you know, there are quite vocal opponents to the carbon tax. Some people do not fully understand the revenue neutrality of the carbon tax, and anytime you use the word tax, people immediately think you're taking more money away from them. And they don't talk about the income tax reductions, the corporate and small business tax reductions that have come into place because of the carbon tax. But regardless, it is a tough issue. You'll not get everyone rowing in the same direction, and at some point, leadership is needed to make that step. And we've been out there for 5 years on this file, and we had hoped that other jurisdictions would come along. I was in Oregon last week testifying before the Joint House Senate Committee on Revenue as they are looking at this policy as well. So we're very encouraged that other jurisdictions are thinking about carbon pricing. It would give us the opportunity to make the next moves forward, because it's difficult to get too far out in front and leave your industries in an uncompetitive situation.
Yeah, you want to have everybody. It's a global problem. All right, well, it just shows how politically problematic it can be. I'm sure we'll keep following it. I hope we can talk again, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Terry Lake is the Minister of Environment in British Columbia. We also talked to Senator Kevin Ranker. The legislature has passed some legislation on climate change in Washington State. There'll be a working group. There'll be a consultant's report. They'll be considering the best practices, including looking at a carbon tax as well as cap and trade and other issues. And that report will be due out in the fall. This is Weekday.
925. Howard Bloom's ideas, it's been said, can penetrate the very foundations of rationality and deconstruct Western consensus reality. Want to go along on that ride? Well, Howard Bloom is here and he's ready to blow your mind less than one consensus reality minute from now.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan Leaf. The 100% electric, zero-emission 2013 Nissan Leaf has new features such as leather-appointed seating for five and never needs gas. More online at choosenissan.com.
51 degrees in Seattle. We got some rain earlier today, and the forecast still calls for a chance of showers with an afternoon high of 59. How does a consistently creative person keep that creative spark alive? KUOW's Marcy Silman gets an answer to that question from dancer and choreographer Jason Olberg in 25 minutes.
So how does the universe create itself out of nothing and then deal with all that carbon? we're gonna make a link right there. We're gonna find out. Howard Bloom is what? So can I call you a hippie?
Well, yeah,
one of the original hippies.
Accidentally helped start the hippie movement.
All right, I don't know what you were thinking. He was a scientific prodigy. At 16, he was working on cancer research in the 70s and 80s. He did PR in the record industry, helped Prince cross over and Styx become more composed when they were on the Wall Street Journal television shows. His interest in consciousness, behavior, math, physics has led to a diverse and interlocking path. Global Brain, the Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century, sparked a Defense Department symposium. His new book is The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Steve.
And in 20 minutes, we will solve the problem of how the universe began. Okay, so I'm just starting. I know there's a lot of story here, but
right.
Please, how does the universe arise without a God?
Well, here's the big deal. If you're 10 years old and you discover you're hooked on science, microbiology and theoretical physics, and then you're 12 years old and you discover you're an atheist, you're up against a problem. The obligation of science is to be brutally truthful about everything. And once you discover you're an atheist, then how in the world did the universe get here? If there's no God saying, let there be light, how in the world did we get light? If there's no God parting the heavens and the seas, how in the world did we get heavens and seas? And so that becomes an enormous problem for you. And the science has not really been working on the answer. If you look at Stephen Hawking's latest book, it's about a year and a half old. It says that, positive energy came from negative energy. Wait a minute. Give me a break here. I mean, isn't the reason that I became an atheist when I was 12 years old the idea that the universe is so complex that only a God could have come up with this universe? And if that's true, then God must be more complex than the universe. And if complex things need gods to create them, then what God created God? So this is another one of those reductio ad absurdums. And what I'm trying to do in this book is, first of all, get across to you just how startling it is that a universe of something should come from nothing. And then in the first 10 to the minus 30 seconds of existence of the universe, not only should a pinprick smaller than a pinprick appear in the middle of nothing, but it should expand as time and space and then precipitate in things when there have never been any things before. How in the world does this happen?
I want an answer.
Yeah, so I haven't so much, I haven't come up with the answers. Those are really big ones. What I've come up with is new ways of thinking of the problem. So the book goes on, it's a kind of a detective hunt, and it's a detective hunt for the roots of the way we think. It's a detective hunt for the logic and the reason that we use in order to figure these things out. And in the process, it turns out the logic and reason that we use, which we sort of regard as universal, just a built-in part of the universe, is artificial. And we came up with it about 2,300 years ago, and we haven't been kicking its tires. We haven't been studying it to see what it's good for and what it's not good
for. All right, so one of the things you, among your five heresies,
right,
in the kicking of the tires,
right,
1 + 1 = 2?
Oh, that's an easy one. Okay, in 1835, two very bright guys are sitting around in England and in London, and they're thinking about this new stuff called chemistry. And you take this one bell jar full of gas and you add it to another bell jar full of gas. Well, 1 + 1 = 2. It should make twice as much gas, right? And Aristotle said, if you break things down to their elements, he called it elementary laws, then you understand everything. So we understand what two gases are, add them together. Now, add a little warmth, just strike a match and throw it in. And you should get just slightly warmer gas, 1 + 1 + 1 = 3, right? That's not the way it works. All of a sudden, there's this whoppingly big explosion. What? An explosion doesn't compute with the elementary laws of two gases. And worse, there's this wiggly, wobbly stuff on the table that's weird as all heck. You can put your finger, you can touch it with your finger like a solid mass, but you can put your finger through it. And if it falls off the table and rolls onto your lap, you're very embarrassed for 15 to 20 minutes until it dries off before you dare walk away again, at least if you're a man. It's this weird stuff called water. Now, this simply does not compute. If you know the elementary properties of these two gases, how do you get wiggly-wobbly stuff plus an explosion?
You tell me science doesn't explain that
today? No. 177 years ago, these two guys, John Stuart Mill, who would later be called the most distinguished philosopher of the 19th century, and another guy named George Henry Luce, would run off with a girl and live in sin with her and cause the scandal of the century. Her name, when she decided to write novels, he convinced her to do it, would be George Eliot. These two guys were sitting around, and it's 177 years ago, and they were saying, our math is still not capable of handling this. Well, guess what? It's 177 years later. Our math is still not capable of handling this.
I'm just a simple country public radio host here.
Yes.
But I have two pens here.
Yeah.
I have one pen. I have two pens.
Yes, you have two pens. But
if you probably could melt them down.
Right, and you could probably melt them down and do all kinds of interesting things. But there are lots of properties where that doesn't happen. I mean, for example, you get together with your wife sometime in the 1980s, and there are just the two of you, and now it's many years later, and you've got two sons going to local Seattle schools, right? Well, that's
pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, that's 2 + 2 = 4. Now, how in the world does that happen? Okay, you could say, but that's not really what we're talking about. The fact is,
that's not what we're talking about.
No, that's the kind of thing that happens in nature all the time. And if you go now to a more elementary level, you've got one little cell from you and one little cell from her, and now you've got these two creatures with 100 trillion cells each wandering around with their own personalities. How in the world does a combination of just 100 trillion cells? I mean, a cell is a cell is a cell. 100 trillion cells is just 100 trillion cells. No, one of them's one sun. The other one's the other sun. They're probably different as can be.
All right. How does that get me to nothingness and then whatever that is? I hope you can tell me what nothingness is. And then how do we get this something out of the nothing?
Well, we still,
without the we can leave God out of this.
Right. Okay.
Please use your science.
Well, okay. In my book ends with this little maraschino cherry on the cake. And the maraschino cherry on the cake is a theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe. And I never thought I believed in cyclical universes. I mean, it explains dark energy and explained it long before dark energy was discovered in 1998. This is a 1959 theory from when I was 16. And you referred to my days in the cancer research lab that came up with this theory. Okay. Now, much to my astonishment, I thought I didn't believe in cyclical universes, that one universe came from the dregs of another universe. But this theory says that that's the way it works. Cyclical universes. One comes from the dregs of another. Now, that doesn't explain anything, Steve.
No.
You still have to explain where this recycling universe came from. And I haven't so much got the answers. What I've got is the limitations of the logic within which we work so that we can see beyond that logic and begin to see to new things.
Is time moving in one direction?
Time is, that's a good question, because time is definitely moving in one direction up here, but this is a big bagel theory of the universe, and it says that a big bang came out of the top of the bagel. At the very center, there's an infinitesimally tiny hole, and on the underside comes the antimatter universe, and the two go the way that a cannonball goes when it arches up into the air, and eventually they run out of energy, and then they start slamming down toward the bagel's outer rim, Well, why? Because they're attracted by each other's gravity. And when they finally meet on the bagel's outer rim, they annihilate. And then they start all over again. Wait, now I've lost track of the question. But at any rate, so there's your cyclical universe. It's real simple. There's your dark energy. Dark energy is, well, how in the world does the universe accelerate away from itself because of the gravity of the universe on the underside? And here's where the question about time comes in.
You knew I was coming.
Yes. Time only goes in one direction up here in the normal universe, but it's conceivable that it goes in the opposite direction down below on the antimatter universe.
Howard Bloom is author of The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. All right, so does that mean there is a universe where things move backwards?
It is possible. According to my theory, you know, sometimes you come up with a theory and you can't work out its implications all at once. I still haven't worked out
whether...
through
the hippie phase, which,
yes,
you know what that meant.
That's true. So we know what that came to. But at any rate, it's still possible that on the underside, time goes in the other direction. But this business that physicists go up against all the time, that time is reversible. No, time's not reversible. Not up here. Not on the positive matter side of things. Time is not reversible.
Do we go away from up here, or are we always within the up here?
We're always within the up here. Unless we figure out some way, someday in the distant future, of wormholing our way to the antimatter universe. And if the antimatter universe goes in reverse, we could actually work out time travel by going backwards in the under universe and coming back up here, let's say, 150 years earlier than today.
Did you just accept the notion of a wormhole without even explaining it?
Yes, I did.
You know, we get these questions when,
yeah,
we get these books sent to us,
right,
and explaining the book, and really they're for cheating.
Right.
So, suggested questions.
Right.
Let's just interject here that you have a lot of gall and should be ashamed of yourself.
I wrote that.
You wrote all this, right?
Yes,
did you write all,
yes,
these questions?
Yes. I write that very skeptically about myself. I mean, it always, you know, science is always about questioning yourself. So you might as well regard yourself with a certain amount of hilarious skepticism.
Why doesn't God come into your picture? I mean, you can
God
insist that you're an atheist.
Picture.
But...
okay. Atheism is a faith. No matter what Richard Dawkins and the boys say, atheism is a faith. And you either believe it or you don't believe it. Well, I'm stuck with it. So everything past that is a rationalization. But the two things that hooked me when I was 12, when I became an atheist, when I realized I was an atheist, one, again, that argument that if a complex thing like a universe needs a God to create it, who created a God? That's one. But the second thing is this. If God is all-powerful, then he created, or she created, death and pain. Death and pain are two monstrous, bloody war atrocities. I mean, these are war crimes beyond belief.
That's there to test you.
Well, yes, there are a lot of theories, and that's one of them. But it's hard for me to believe that Archibald MacLeish, the poet, put it this way. If God is God, he is not good. Meaning if God is all-powerful, then he's not good because he created these ghastly things. And if God is good, he is not God. He's not all powerful. And that's the basic conundrum.
The second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Entropy.
That one is so far off the wall that it is hard for me to believe that any of my colleagues in science have ever, ever been able to accept it.
Explain it, and then why is it off the wall?
Okay, it's off the wall. The second law of thermodynamics says that all things are falling apart. All things are tending toward disorder. And you've heard a million times about the sugar cube, and you drop it in a glass of water, and you stir, and eventually the sugar cube, which was a nicely shaped geometric shape, all of a sudden is nothing. It's a swizzle. It's a twirl. And that is the cosmos, according to everybody back to Rutherford, who came up with the idea of heat death, that the
whole
universe will die
that way. Isn't
that
your bagel theory?
No, not at all. Because you start with a blip, okay? You and I are sitting at a coffee table before there was ever a universe, and you are a visionary, and I'm a crusty old crump, and you say, I tell you that any second now, over there in that corner, there's going to be a pinprick infinitely smaller than a pinprick. And I say, Steve, look, we've been sitting around here forever, and there never has been such a thing. And all of a sudden, there it is. What's worse is it starts unfurling as a sheet of space and time. Space and time? Where did space and time come from? Is that things getting more disordered? No, that's two forms of order that never existed before. And then you come up with another one of your crazy predictions, and you say, see that unfurling sheet of space and time that's just moving at super speed? I predict that any second now, space and time is going to precipitate the way that raindrops precipitate from a storm cloud into things. And I say, Steve, look, now I know you've lost it. We're sitting here in the nothing. Got it? We've been sitting here for a very long time. And it's called the nothing for a reason. Look at those words, Steve. No thing. There have never been any things. There never will be any things. And whammo, you've got it. Quarks by the gazillions and leptons by the gazillions. Now, is this nothingness turning into time and space, and time and space speeding at incredible speed, turning into quarks and leptons, order running down, order running out, things becoming more confused? No, it's order running up. The universe is constantly running up a ladder of some sort of form. It is constantly generating new creative something or others. How the hell does it do it?
Why is it creating? Why is it something or others? I mean, there's explosions, things emerge from the explosions,
right.
Things destroy. Why is that? Isn't that our language putting
yes,
order to
that? Yes, that's definitely our language putting something to it, and we don't know how it occurs. And when intelligent design people use a word like design, they don't look at what's behind that. We have 30 different vision processing centers in our brains, and we are imagining that there needs to be a deity who has 30 visual processing centers in his brain and whose ability to imagine in advance what something will be like, that is vision, envision in advance what something will be like, is equivalent to ours. That's crazy. Gods don't need 30 different vision centers in their brains if there ever were gods. But one way or the other, surprise and new varieties of form keep popping up. And they include atoms, and they include stars, and they include galaxies.
So is it all based on principles of science? Principles of not science, principles of energy and... Well, I can't even ask the question.
No.
What are they based on?
No. And the reason I say no is, yes, it's all based on principles of some sort, but the same sort of principles that John Stuart Mill and George Henry Luce were talking about in 1835 when they were wondering how in the world does an explosion and a liquid come from a gas. There's some sort of principle in there that isn't in our current logic, believe it or not, and is not in our current math, and it is the key, a key, to cosmic creativity, and we need to be able to step outside our logic to understand just how far we need to step.
Howard Bloom is author of The God Problem. How do you step outside your logic? You are within the frame of, we're within the frames of our reference. How would we be able to do that?
Well, we're already doing it. We are doing it with computers. I mean, up till now, we've been heavily dependent on our mathematics. Our mathematics is heavily dependent on Aristotle. Aristotle says if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. And you'll find that underlying what we call equations, that equal between things. And we're already getting beyond the limitations of that form of logic with computers. Stephen Wolfram has been taking axioms, basic assumptions, and feeding them into a computer and telling the computer, if these are our basic assumptions, what kind of universe emerges? And he's done it with millions of different kind of universes without standard math. And if you look very carefully at the things that Stephen Wolfram is saying, and this is a mathematical genius, he came up with the program Mathematica that every major mathematician in the world uses. And yet he says what we've discovered is this old form of math that we inherited from the Babylonians. Sorry, just one form of math among millions and millions of potential forms of math. And now he says with his system of simulating universes in a computer by starting from elementary assumptions, now we get beyond that math, perhaps. Well, one way or the other, whether we do it with Wolfram's techniques or not, we have to step beyond that math.
Beyond that math.
Yes.
That's just, I don't even, that's another one of those ideas.
It's yes.
Like, that's like stepping into dark matter.
Yeah, it's like
or
stepping
dark in, energy.
Yes, but at least dark energy is the beginning of putting your finger on a mystery, and this is the beginning of putting your finger on a mystery. It shows what direction we have to go.
All right, sir. I'm sorry, but I have to take a moment here because here we are having these conversations and you're a cancer researcher and you're a hippie. How do you end up telling sticks to be more composed when they're talking on television stations?
Well, this is okay. When I was 13 and realized that I was an atheist, there were two big questions. One is, okay, you little thing, if you don't believe in a God, then how in the world does the cosmos create? And number two is this. If your parents are literally trying to drag you by your ankles off to high holiday services while you hang on to the door frame of their blue Fraser and refuse to go, if they feel that intensely about a god, then where are the gods? And if every tribe you've ever read about at the age of 13, I'd been reading two books a day since I was 10 by then, has got gods or some sort of supernatural forces, if every single one of them has got gods in some form, then where are the gods? If they're not in the sky, if they're not in the ground, if they're not in the air around you, then they're behind your nose. then they're inside of you someplace, and they're as accessible to you, atheist or not, as they are to your parents. So your job is to find the gods inside. And I grew up in the wake of World War II. I grew up in the wake of the Holocaust. And there was a man who was brilliant at playing the gods inside, who was brilliant at playing those things that give you a sense of stepping out of yourself and becoming part of a higher power. His name was Adolf Hitler. He was an absolute master at this stuff. So I wanted to know about the gods inside of us and how an Adolf Hitler plays them, how they become the forces of history.
Wow, you really...
Yeah, and that led me into rock and roll. Now, that's a long story because I didn't belong in rock and roll.
All right. Let me ask you.
Yeah.
And this is a personal question.
Go ahead.
Your brain races.
Yeah.
You absorb much information. We have, of course, we being the culture, has
right.
a notion that folks like you have a hard time holding on to reality. You get unhappy. You have... psychosis, not you personally, but
yeah.
these notions.
I've had all those things, so.
So this is my question. How right. have you stayed sane?
Right.
How have you stayed sane?
Well, there's some question as to whether I've stayed sane or not.
Well, you're safe and healthy. How about that? That would be enough,
I've
wouldn't
had
it?
The time of my life, Steve. I mean, science is really about the permission to adventure, and it's the permission to adventure intellectually and emotionally. If you're going to find out about something, there's this old concept in science called participant-observer science. Hasn't been around for a long time, but it's very important. And it is immerse yourself in something. Margaret Mead did it. How do you get to know the Samoans? You become a chief. She was named a chieftainess. Well, so I knew nothing about rock and roll. I knew nothing about popular culture. It wasn't easy for me to get into popular culture, but that's where I was going to find out this Hitlerian mystery.
Did and you, by the way? Do you feel you did?
To a large extent, yes, because rock and roll turned out to be one of those areas where the gods are. Look what happens when there's a concert. The audience is the ultimate goal is getting off, right? And getting off means achieving that kind of ecstatic state in which you become part of something bigger than yourself.
If you said you had through all those things. So when you fell into despair, what brought you back up?
That's a very good question, and I don't know. I can't exactly tell you.
But you did come out.
There is something inside of you, if you're lucky, that has a survival instinct that is bigger than you are, and it keeps pulling you out no matter what. And curiosity is one of those things that helps. And feeling that you're alive for a reason, and if you're on a quest that started when you were 10 years old, well, and you stay on it, and you stay where your passions are for the rest of your life, it keeps you motivated.
Howard Bloom's book is The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Whoo, boy. All right. Take a deep breath. Let's get ready to move on here. How to Keep Creativity Alive, a conversation with Seattle-based choreographer and dancer Jason Olberg in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
This Week in This American Life. Andrea's head tingles, and I mean it literally tingles, when she hears the sound of typing, the flipping of pages, or people talking like this.
This is gentle whispering.
Now then, barely touch the canvas.
I'm going to share something personal.
Andrea always thought that she was the only one who felt these tingles. But was she? This week.
Saturday morning at 11.
Hello, this is Renee Montaigne. NPR is an independent news source. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you intelligent stories of people and their communities, stories you won't hear anywhere else. And your financial support makes that possible. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your support right now, I don't mean tomorrow, I mean right now, will help keep the upcoming pledge drive on target. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks from all of us. 52 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Little rain earlier today, and the forecast says we could still get some showers. We're expecting to hit a high of 59. 9:48, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Have you ever heard the sound of howler monkeys in the Guatemalan rainforest, specifically at sunrise? No? Well, stick around. We're doing that in 10 minutes.
By the way, Howard Bloom, 6 p.m. tonight, Ellie Bay Bookstore. But first, and other things you can do in the world of creativity, dance, which is all over this city. This city has become more vibrant with dance every year. Marcy, someone's been tracking it and talking to some of the people who are there.
Good. Pretty amazing, yes. From high dance, if you want to think of ballet that way, to what comes out of Velocity Dance Center on Capitol Hill, you can pretty much every weekend find dance. And last weekend, I went to Seattle Dance Project's Project 6, which is their sixth year of existence. And Seattle Dance Project's a group of folks who used to be ballet dancers, and after you know at a certain age you can't,
they got too old,
a little bit too old for doing that, but they still dance. And this year's project is featuring two dances by a choreographer named Jason Olberg, and I went to see the dances. They were pretty great, and I started to look up some information about the choreographer, and there wasn't much, and so thought I would just invite him in and sort of like ask him who he was. So this is our conversation.
You know, I think that sort of decision happened for me. I went to a performing art high school, and dance was sort of my introduction into the arts with tap and jazz, because I wanted to be in a local dinner theater. They had a junior company, and I thought, well, I can sing okay, but I need to dance. So I started taking dance lessons, and it kind of just became my first love, even though that wasn't my prime motivation.
So you thought sort of like Broadway-esque theater. Absolutely. Kind of thing was what you had planned to do. So at what point did the dance part take over?
Probably when I was about 16, I was dating someone in college that was very, you know, scandalous at the moment, but took me to San Francisco to see a production of a performance of Paul Taylor, actually, at UC Berkeley. And that was the first time I'd ever really seen modern contemporary dance. And it just sort of blew my mind, opened my eyes, made me fall in love, all that kind of stuff. And from then on, my focus went much more towards heading toward New York, concert dance versus, you know, I'm going to go to LA and try and be on the Academy Awards or, you know, be in a video.
16's, I suppose, a little late for people to discover that they're going to be dancers. A lot of people that I talk to know from 4, because they can't sit still and their mothers decide that they are going to go in movement classes, and
right,
and their lives progress. So that you have a little bit different story.
Yeah, and I think most men that I tend to talk to have a little bit of a different story or a sideways backdoor into dance, and it happens a little bit later. I think it might be getting a little more difficult. The world's getting much more competitive now, but at the time, it was absolutely feasible to start dancing, you know, into your teens, or even some people into their late teens, early 20s, and still manifest a career for yourself.
When did you know that you wanted to actually make dance, make them yourself?
You know, right after I left Hubbard Street, and it was a fairly short-lived career in the company, I started kind of playing with it, and two pieces came out of me really fast, really quick, right away, that have stayed kind of in my rep that I pull around from time to time, because they were these sort of wonderful, idyllic experiences. I created them with some very close people to me. We kind of found this lifelong friendship through it, and they're just really, I don't know, it's sometimes I feel like with choreographers, some of the first few things you make are really wonderful because you have all this energy or all these ideas pent up inside of you. And then once you get a company going and you start having to create things on a regular basis, then you really find out, okay, what's in here in terms of craft, and what have I really learned about being able to make something out of nothing?
Well, the thing that strikes me, and I know that there are many workshops around the country, but you don't go to school for choreography necessarily.
You know, most conservatory programs, you do study composition, and well, there'll be a handful of people within a given class that will focus on that. But again, the real structure of it and the real art of it comes to be when you really are just forced to do it. And I've been very fortunate in that I've had a few people that have believed in me over the years who have brought me in as resident choreographer or given me opportunities.
You talked about those first pieces being really idyllic because, you know, they weren't assignments. You're working with friends. Would you say that you're inspired by what you hear? Do you have ideas in your head before you go in? Where do you start? And how is it different from that first dance?
I can start several different ways. I think earlier I was more idea driven, but always I've been incredibly music focused. I mean, if I hear a piece of music that inspires me, I'll just sort of be transported into composition, not even necessarily movement, but just my brain starts thinking in terms of structure. And it'll happen to me in weird times. I recently was watching a film, you know, at home, and this it was Beasts of the Southern Wild, and the young girl would be, you know, putting her ear up into an animal's heartbeat, and this music would be playing, and I would just stop dead. And it's funny, my husband just kind of glanced over and said, "It's happening, isn't it?" And I just kind of said, "Shh, you know, don't talk to me right now. It's yes, it's happening." So it can happen at the weirdest moments.
When you're presented a commission, or you're hired and brought in to work with a certain group, does that take you in a different direction than if you were in a studio with dancers that you've hand chosen? And
oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. It's undeniably. I think you always have to sort of look at what you've been given to work with. There are several times where I've choreographed for example, Cornish College of the Arts for their student programs. And you go in and you have auditions and you hope to get certain people, and you wind up, you know, having to jockey between four other choreographers who you're going to get. And then you sort of look at what you have and you start to create from there.
How often do you yourself perform these days?
Pretty rarely. Every now and again, if I have somebody whose work I like or a colleague that I respect will ask me to do something, and I might. Usually maybe once a year.
Is it hard to make dance or be in a dance that you've made?
It's terribly hard. I mean, it is very hard because there's no one sitting out to watch and be able to fine-tune things or clean things or even just to sit outside and say, is this working in any way, shape, or form?
How long have you been here working?
I've been in Seattle about 12 years.
How does our dance community compare to, say, Chicago, the Chicago bigger city, or New York even?
You know, it definitely has a very unique flavor to it. There tends to be less paid work for dancers in Seattle in terms of opportunity and companies that get funding. There are a handful more in Chicago and several more in New York, but they also are a lot more dancers. And I think there, in all cities, there is a huge wave of independent choreographers and people who are kind of founding companies, starting companies. Seattle strikes me as a company that's very, or not a company, but a city that's very heavy in independent choreographers that have sort of decided to start their own group and self-produce.
Does the fact that we are where we are, i.e. far from major dance centers, if you will, does that affect in your mind the kind of work that comes out of all these independent choreographers? Is there a Seattle style or something unique?
I think there has been. I think that's starting to change, but I think there up until recently there has been sort of a voice in this area. And I think a lot of it comes from Cornish College because it is a big conservatory that's turning out year after year classes of people who, you know, when you develop yourself in a city after school, it's kind of hard to leave and just thrust yourself into an unknown place where you don't have any connection. So a lot of them stay. And because there isn't a lot of work, they start making their own things. And I think that has led to a sort of a uniform voice in Seattle. But I do see more people moving here. I see people sharing ideas, doing lots of residencies across city lines. And I see that voice starting to blend a little bit and start to be influenced and attracting outside people.
What keeps you here besides your husband?
I moved here to quit. I moved here to quit dance. I had been here on tour and I thought it was gorgeous. I obviously came in August. and I was deciding what to do after I was getting ready to make a transition, and it just seemed like a great place to come. And I was here maybe 4 or 5 months before I first got a phone call saying, oh, so-and-so has recommended you. We need a sub to teach something, or we would like you to set a piece on something. And I took it as a sign that I should say yes. And so it's never really worked out.
Why did you want to quit?
It's an incredibly obsessive career. It's very all or nothing. And the allness of it sometimes gets exhausting. It's something you can't escape from very much. And your mind just is always involved.
What would you do if you weren't?
That was a super good question. you know, I trained as a Pilates instructor and have built a big Pilates clientele and worked as a personal trainer. And that's very rewarding in its own way and enjoyable in its own way. But there is something creative in terms of making something that is missing from that. And I don't know that I think I may have given up on the idea that I can ever get out of the need to create.
Choreographer Jason Oberg talked to Marcy Silman. You can see his work this weekend. Seattle Dance Project will be performing two of Oberg's dances at ACT Theater. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
You're in the jungles in Guatemala, Tikal, the capital of the Mayan civilization, located in the Petén rainforest. Sunrise drawing closer. Those are howler monkeys around the rainforest canopy. Listener Jerry recorded that sound while sitting on top of the principal pyramid, listening to this sound of nature. Cool. Jerry had a little wind too, huh? Wow, that's great. All right, what are you hearing? Either when you're in Guatemala or, you know, when you're down at Shilshol. I don't know. You know, there's all sorts of strange and interesting sounds around us. You just got to listen to them. And then you have to record 30 seconds of it on your special smart device or otherwise. And then send it to us with the story behind it. Email weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Stay with us. We're going to find out about Yokohama. We're also going to find out what's been happening with the Supreme Court and the DOMA arguments. We'll get a lunch review and recommendation from Sarah Dickerman. Lots of weekday ahead. Watch out for the monkeys.
. 9:59. Nelson Mandela is in the hospital with a lung infection. They say he's responding positively to treatment. We'll get an update in the news in a moment. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Compost Days, celebrating the Northwest's accomplishments in composting food and yard waste. Now through April.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.